I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Rosie, come here, sweetie. Come here.
Oh, she's coming.
Oh, she stopped. Come here, Rose. I want to say hi. I just want a hug. I want to commune. Hey, nice to see you. Friday night, Rosie, we're going to be curled up on the sofa in about 2 hours. Watching Tin Star. Yeah, it's getting exciting, isn't it?
It's a free Tin Star plug there. I'm enjoying it. Anyway, how are you doing, listeners? Adam Buxton here. Just out for a walk with Rose as the sun goes down. The nights are definitely drawing in. Autumn is on the horizon. And then winter. It's nearly Christmas. All right, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me tell you about this week's episode. Podcast number 49, which features a conversation recorded in June of this year, 2017, with documentarian, journalist, and unlikely tattoo star, Louis Theroux. Google Louis Theroux tattoos. You'll be surprised how many people have made the decision to tattoo the face of Louis onto parts of their body. Many of those tattoos double as Harry Potter tattoos because they've gone for a young incarnation of Louis with round specs. And it looks for all the world like a young Daniel Radcliffe. But anyway, I digress. We don't talk about the tattoos in this conversation. We started out talking about drugs, specifically heroin. And from there, we moved on to a couple of encounters that Louis has had in the past with some legends of the documentary genre. We also talked about podcast documentary sensation S-Town, which caused such a stir earlier this year, although we did focus mainly on the voices of S-Town's presenter and subject, and that's when we weren't going off on tangents. And I should say at this point that if you haven't heard S-Town, I'm imagining that most of you podcasts have, but if you have not heard S-Town and you'd like to avoid spoilers, best not listen to the second half of this podcast just yet. And in that second half, there are one or two moments that I considered cutting out today, specifically a couple of incredibly bad impressions and a bit of negativity from me as well, which I regret, because I'm not a fan of the negativity, but I kept them in because they made us laugh at the time. And we were laughing really at how shit we were being, as in useless. So I hope you'll take those moments in the right spirit. I mean, if you are one of the people that we were talking about, then I sincerely apologize, and I hope you'll let me buy you a drink to say sorry sometime. Here we go!
What have you been doing today, Lou?
I was up at 5 to film in an anorexia clinic, an eating disorders clinic. That's the new thing. That's what we're filming in. It's about eating disorders.
And is that part of a series that's coming out on the BBC?
Basically, I think it'll be a one-off. You know, I've done a three-parter in America about crime.
Right.
Which is nearly done. We're just editing the last one. And so we needed to do another program. And anorexia and eating disorders was in the hopper as a sort of one that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And also because I'm moving back to the States in August with the family, I liked the idea of doing a UK one before we went.
Mm. How was the crime scene in America? Whereabouts were you?
Three different cities. The first one is Milwaukee. Homicide in Milwaukee. It's got a very, very high murder rate.
Unhappy Days.
That is set in Milwaukee.
That's right.
Very true. Why can't the Fonz sort it out? It's now a bit of a homicide capital. It's a sad story. Also, sex trafficking in Houston. Trafficking doesn't mean smuggling. It means pimping, basically. Guys who have little bands of women who they basically transport around, move from motel to motel, and then they take all their money. It's a very odd arrangement. They are, it's like a little cult where the pimp is in charge of a stable of women who's, they, you know, using brute force and psychological intimidation and a kind of cult-like control, he pimps them out and takes their money. Very odd. And the third one is about heroin in Huntington, West Virginia, the heroin epidemic.
How long has that been going on then? Because I've started hearing more and more about it.
The heroin situation, we're in the middle of a crescendo, so we haven't reached peak heroin. It's gone up year on year for the last, I'm guessing, 4 or 5 years. But it's been going on. The opiates epidemic has been going on since the late 90s.
Does that include prescribed medication?
Well, that's how it started. It started with prescription drugs, and then it built because, to give you the background, there were these big pharmaceutical companies which created and marketed these painkillers based on opium, like
OxyContin.
OxyContin,
would that be
one? Is the famous one.
Yeah, because while I was having a glib conversation with Claudia O'Doherty, this comedian, Australian comedian who now lives in LA, and she was telling me about how she'd accidentally taken OxyContin and spent the weekend tripping balls, basically.
It's heavy, heavy stuff. And you have 20s, 40s, and 80s. 80s are the most powerful. And it would tranquilize a horse, from what I understand. And based on a slightly misunderstood and very limited study, scientific study, they were marketed as non-addictive, but that's balls. And there was rampant addiction throughout America and especially places in the Midwest and parts of New England and also very much so around the Appalachian Mountains. Something to do with heavy industry and places with large working class populations that get workplace injuries.
Right. They just need to manage pain.
Managing back pain. So it was a paradoxical effect where they finally tightened up the regulations on prescribing these drugs when they realized how many people were getting addicted. But instead of fixing the problem, all the people who could no longer get their OxyContin then started taking heroin because that's what they couldn't get their usual drugs. And that led to rampant overdose because from knowing how much they were taking in each pill, suddenly they're getting these very variable quantities of heroin.
Much harder to manage.
Often laced with even more powerful drugs called fentanyl or carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer. And so there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of overdoses and deaths every year from
heroin.
And
did you get a sense of how people make that transition from taking prescribed medication in a fairly formal way, getting a prescription from a doctor or whatever, to going and taking illegal drugs? How does that happen?
Well, it's very straightforward. I mean, literally the doctor will say, look, I'm not going to issue you another prescription. And then the person will go off and get dope sick, go into a very heavy withdrawal, and then seek out a heroin dealer. Or in other cases, it's people who aren't getting from the doctors. You know, these places were awash with prescription drugs. Whether or not they were prescribed legally, you know, people would get phony prescriptions, or they would just dip into their family members' drugs supplies. But then once it was all tightened up, everyone moved en masse into illegal heroin. I mean, you might be getting it from the same dealer. You might have been getting prescription drugs illegally, and then your man says, well, I haven't got any oxys. What about some black tar heroin?
Hmm.
Yes, please.
And then as part of your program, were you in any way speculating
as
to having heroin cakes?
I did not take any.
None. Have you ever taken any?
Heroin?
Yeah.
No.
Would you admit it if you had?
Would I admit it if I had?
It would be weird, wouldn't
would
it?
Would I? It would, maybe it would skew the program. Not.
Yeah.
In, well, here and now or in the program?
Just generally, it's not the sort
of thing. I probably wouldn't.
It would be fraught with too
My
many.
My kids, you know, are at the age where they hear about stuff.
Yeah.
But I haven't taken it. No. I think my dad wrote in one of his books about smoking opium. He definitely did in The Great Railway Bazaar, which I remember reading about when I was about 11 years old. So there's sort of a
Did your dad ever give you a big drug talk? Or did he just assume that you would find your way and you'd be careful?
I got very mixed messages on drugs because I was reading my dad's books and reading about him getting high. But then when I started experimenting with weed, hash, ganj, I've never alighted on the perfect word. Have you? What is your favourite cannabis?
Doobie?
That's the worst.
Why is it bad? Because it's just so lame.
Doobie.
I like a bit of doobie. Reminds me of the Doobie Brothers.
Isn't that?
Why were they called the Doobie Brothers?
Because they liked doobie.
Well, that's good then.
It just sounds...
The Doobie Brothers were good.
It sounds insipid.
It does, yeah. So you want something that sounds hard.
Once you got any shit. Hash, anyway, was what we smoked back in the day. Right. And when I told, I think I even went to him and said, oh yeah, Dad, I went and got high last night. Like thinking, you go like, oh, nice one, son. Mm. Not only was he not pleased, he became sort of annoyed and passive aggressive. Like he knew he couldn't really kind of go off the deep end. That wasn't his style generally anyway. But he was like, well, what are you doing? Really? Why? I mean, you could get expelled. I mean, I don't mind you doing it, but you didn't want to come on square, so he had some weird reason for why it was a bad idea.
I mean, that's the thing.
Like, you might even be like, you don't even know if you're getting good shit.
Right,
you know, like
right.
Something as random as that.
Yeah. Because he doesn't have a leg to stand on. That's the thing, is that if you're a parent that's experimented in your younger days, then what do you say? I mean, it's so nakedly hypocritical for a child to hear that.
The sad part is I genuinely went into it thinking, oh, Dad's going to be cool with it.
Yeah.
Me and Dad can bond like, hey, son, did you get wasted?
Let's do some hot knives.
Hey, yeah, let's hot knife right now. I'll give you a blowback. and instead of which, he was all huffy about it.
Well, Frank Zappa famously, I remember, instructed his children that if they did any drug experimentation, it was to be done in the house. Yeah, Zappa himself, he smoked a lot of ciggies. I don't think he ever did drugs.
He famously was anti-drugs.
Yeah. And at various points, I think most of the children went off the rails.
Did they?
I don't know. I mean, it's a sad story because the Zappa clan is at war with each other now.
Is it?
Yeah. Over who has the rights to the music and to play the music and this and that.
And which ones have fallen out? The two boys?
I think the two boys, and I think maybe Dweezil. I think Gail, their mother, is no longer with us. I think she died, right?
But do they both want to play the music?
I lost track.
You know, Gallagher, the American, he might even be Canadian, comedian, had a brother, and Gallagher's act was basically all prop-driven, and he would do things.
He smashed watermelons
was one of his famous bits. And he licensed his brother to do the act, and his brother looked a lot like him as well. And the brother went on, maybe even as Jimmy Gallagher, or I'm not quite sure what, but became very successful. And then Gallagher says, I want you to stop doing it now. And then they've had a huge falling out. He's like, I'm not going to. I'm the real Gallagher, you know?
Yeah.
Bit like Noel and Liam. Maybe the name is cursed.
So, God, that's... I mean, I feel as if I've almost certainly asked you before, but how do you stop yourself getting really...
Depressed
when you're doing stories like this? Where do you find the hope in them? Or do you not? Is that not something you have to think about?
It's very odd, but somehow...
Or is it because you're an emotionless robot?
I don't think it's that. I think what it is that the people that we tend to film with have some spark to them and actually some sort of dark glamour. Even in the world of heroin, and don't get me wrong, heroin is an awful, awful drug and it's destructive and it destroys lives and it destroys families. But there's nothing in this world that is completely and wholly negative. You know, in other words, there has to be some element of seduction, some attraction there. Otherwise, no one would do anything bad. And with heroin, there's a sort of outlaw glamour that goes with it, a kind of exciting, Bonnie and Clyde lifestyle. And the people very often are rather attractive, kind of piratical, Keith Richards-esque figures, you know. They're out on the limb, kind of leading lives of passionate intensity. Yeah. And most of them are not just taking heroin. They're either dealing it or have dealt it or have trafficked it. And they're in this sort of world in which it's anti-bourgeois, leading a life without consequences. Usually they've got kids that have been taken into care, which is clearly horrible and massively destructive, but it's hard to put into words, but there's a certain
subversive,
some kind of thrill, weird transgressive charm.
Transgressive, right. I mean, those are the exciting ones. I would imagine the vast majority of people who are struggling are just sort of having a pathetic time of it, really.
Also, I like to think that the other way of looking at it is that you're talking about people who, in the act of connecting with you, are reaching out for some kind of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And they see you as a little bit of a lifeline. I mean, that's not the whole story, because there's another part of them that may even romanticize their own bad choices and want them memorialized in a documentary, right? That's there. But there's another sense in which they may see you as a redemptive kind of lifeline, and that they want help coming out as addicts in some cases. They want help connecting with someone who's outside their drug user circle. And this goes across the board, because I'm also, you know, in the other stories, there was a prostitute who had a pimp who we filmed with quite a bit. And you had the sense that she was just grateful to speak to someone who represented the square world and connect with that a bit. And I feel like, as much as I have a slightly maybe unhealthy fascination with the macabre qualities of the demimonde, I also genuinely think there's, and it's not necessarily why I do it, but I think it's perhaps why I'm okay doing it, is that you're connecting with someone who is kind of reaching towards the light in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I made it sound quite good then. Before it sounded bad.
Right. First of all, you started off saying more or less they're all like Johnny Depp and they're exciting and it's fun.
And everyone should be on heroin.
And everyone should at least try it.
And then I realized that horse,
and then you thought,
that dog didn't hunt. So then it became, actually, I'm like a therapist.
Actually, I'm like Jesus. And I'm the only person that is in any way providing any excitement.
You know, I was like, you know, I was only saying that they're like role models and we should all be badasses, because why would you be a square, man? You're so square in your boxes, man. And then it became, but I like to connect with the people because I am light and life to them as a sort of therapist.
You're a therapist. I thought you were turning into Herzog.
I don't know what I was trying to be a therapist. So, no, I didn't take heroin. Did it cross my mind? Very, very fleetingly. It always crosses my mind when I'm doing an extreme story. You know, because going back to Weird Weekends, it was always about participation. And I remember when we did the porn episode, and I thought, if I was a real documentary maverick, I would actually have sex on camera, probably.
But you must have thought that through and realised that that would compromise you in so many other ways that it wasn't worth it.
Well, what I thought was, actually, that's quite an ugly thing, both morally and literally. Like to see that, it's just repulsive on several levels, isn't it? When you think it through, quite quickly you realise, well, yes, there's an element of cowardice involved in that decision.
They would have pixelated you.
I don't want to be
though,
embarrassed.
Right?
No, but it's not even like, it's not the ugliness of the actual testicles, the ball sack, the glands, the shaft. I mean, it's not that specifically.
The gleaming shaft.
It's not the, what do they call it? The brown, what was a horrible term for your bum. Not your brown asterisk. It's not like that. But it's more just the image. Even if you pixelated everything, you're still seeing a pasty, geeky, bespectacled man on top of a vulnerable, probably very damaged porn performer, female. I mean, no one, that's awful. Why are we even
That's
talking
the way
about
the modern
it?
World works, man. People love it.
Robbie Williams said that to me, though, oddly enough.
What, that you shouldn't?
He said, I can't really do the when I met him, I've only met him once, he said, oh, I like your stuff. I just saw the porn one. This was literally about 17 years ago. And he said, but why didn't you have sex?
Right.
Why didn't you go all the way, you know, and have sex with someone on camera? Because as you know, if you've seen the film, that episode of Weird Weekends, I dress up as a park ranger and I'm in a gay porn film in a non-sex role. And I also strip naked and get my Polaroid taken and we pixelate the shot of standing naked, but I am properly naked. And then I get an offer, I get a genuine offer of a role in a sex film that's a rape fantasy film called Forced Entry. That's sort of the...
Oh, yes, who that was the
Rob
creepy...
Rob Black, right, yeah, a kind of creepy, off-the-wall... director who likes shaking things up, and he goes, Geraldo Rivera would do that, man. Morley Safer would. He starts naming American TV journalists.
Geraldo Rivera wouldn't do that.
No way. Who would have taken a role in a, you know, as having sex in a porn film? Robbie Williams thought I should have done it. I don't know if he just thought he was saying that.
Well, there would be a lot of people online that would like to see that. There's probably a whole sub.
Embarrassed about. There's a photo of me naked but for a feather boa.
Oh, I remember that in the Time Out.
I'm still embarrassed about that one.
That's not too bad, that photo. That's still online though, right?
It makes me cringe. Yeah, you can find it.
You look a bit goofy. I mean, you look
you
as
just
if...
said it wasn't too bad and now it's goofy.
Goofy's not too bad. I've been in way worse photos. I mean, maybe not naked, but...
Because even in the darkest abyss... That maybe that is.
That's getting close to Herzog.
I liked your one. I thought about you. When you have the mind of a wolverine.
Wolverine.
Why don't chimpanzees ride horses? I don't know how he would say horses.
Horses.
Why don't chimpanzees ride horses?
Why don't chimpanzees ride horses?
Don't chimpanzees ride wolverines?
Have you come across Herzog?
I did. I had a lunch with dinner with Herzog when I was in LA.
Did you recently?
Yeah. No, it was when I was living there, which was about 3 years ago. A friend of mine called Zach Penn, who's a screenwriter. And he's also directed a couple of mockumentaries. And I don't know how he knows Herzog, but he knows him. And he put Herzog in one of his films as an actor. And he had a dinner and we went round and had dinner with Herzog.
How was that?
It was great. I asked him about, because I've seen loads of his docs. I asked him about one in which he goes to an island, a volcanic island, that's in which they're about to have a volcanic eruption. And it's been evacuated. In classic Herzogian fashion, he decides to go there, even with the volcano about to go off, and interview the three or four people who are still there, who've decided to stay, even though they'll be covered in lava, right? And he said, my cameraman said to him, going in and out of the accent, his cameraman said to him, well, what are we going to do if it actually erupts while we're there? And Herzog said, we will be airborne. That was his. So he's got like his little trove of anecdotes like that, and he's quite fun on that. I mean that was, he was quite deaf was the other thing, and I remember saying like Werner, like literally be at the table, Werner, and he was getting a bit embarrassing, like everyone else sort of at the table was aware that I was trying to get his attention.
Were you in a loud restaurant?
No, we were just at Zach Penn's house, but when I said Werner, he turned around. I think he's just used to people calling him Werner.
Ah, okay.
So he actually answers to that better.
Not Werner.
Werner.
And you recently met David Attenborough.
I did, David. I've had quite a...
Racking up all the great documentaries.
I've had a kind of a slightly odd thing where I did an interview with David Attenborough 2 weeks ago for the Radio Times. And then literally on Sunday, I interviewed Nick Broomfield.
Right, because he was the man when we were growing up.
I don't even know if I knew who he was in my teens. Did you?
In my late teens, yeah.
Did you? The first I heard of him was 93 when I was living in New York when Aileen Wuornos, Selling of a Serial Killer, came mm-hmm. out. Was he on your radar before that?
I think so, because he did the one with the South African...
Yeah, I didn't know about that one at that time.
What was the name of the guy?
It's about Eugene Terblanche.
There you go, Terblanche.
And it's called
The Driver.
The Leader, His Driver, and The Driver's Wife.
There you go. So I remember that was a
really?
Big deal.
On yeah. Channel 4 or something?
Yeah. So he was an interesting fellow to talk to, I'm sure.
He was
sure.
great, and you know, he's got a reputation for being occasionally... a difficult interviewee. And I'd been told that by one or two people. But in fact, I found him very charming. He doesn't play the show business game. But he's got some funny stories. I remember that my opening question was, you know, you've made many different kinds of films in different modes. But there is a thing you are known for. A very quintessential kind of Nick Broomfield approach to filmmaking. How would you characterize it? And he was like, well, I don't really think of my films in that way. I just see films as problems to be solved. And I was like, okay. I mean, in a way you could say that it was a shitty question for me to ask out of the gate. Because I'm sort of saying, like, do my job for me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, what's that?
Who are you? I just thought it would be interesting to see how he characterized his sense of who he was professionally. You know what I mean? Like, I was just curious to see whether he would be able to say... Well, you know, there's a certain approach that I've pioneered, which is first-person documentary gonzo journalism, in which I'm a protagonist in the stories that I attempt to tell. Right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to get that kind of Wikipedia headline from him, I thought, rather than me doing it, I'd rather hear him do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he also doesn't want to be Wikipedia, and actually... Fair enough.
Is that how you would answer that question then?
For him?
No, for you.
For me, I would say something slightly different. I mean, I think I'm, what's the term? Ingratiating enough. And I don't say that necessarily as a positive, that I would sort of step up and say, well, I guess people see me as a kind of slightly fish out of water journalist who gets into scrapes attempting to tell the story. I'm a presenter who likes to get involved in my stories, you know, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd be more, I'm happy to step up and be the cliche.
Hello, my friend, it's good to see you again. I've got to say, you're looking great. I love what you've done with your nipples and your knees and your shiny bald pate.
So earlier this year, 2017, it seemed like everyone was obsessed, certainly in the podcast world, with S-Town. It's a documentary that came out of the This American Life stable, presented by Brian Reed. There was a period when everyone was listening to it where you couldn't discuss it because people would go, spoilers!
Right.
Spoilers! And that's like...
Do you ever say that?
No, I don't, because I don't care.
No.
I just think it'll be fine. It's not going to totally ruin my enjoyment of a thing if I know vaguely what's going to happen.
Yeah.
There are times when... It takes the edge off the fun. But really, if the thing is fundamentally worthwhile...
What did people say before they said spoiler alert? Because that's a 10-year. It was just, oh, don't ruin the ending.
Yes, don't ruin the ending. Oh, no, I haven't seen it.
Don't ruin the ending. Oh, you ruined the ending.
That's the thing.
Ruin the ending. I want to go back to... Like, I'm going to start a campaign to bring back the phrases that predate the phrases we use
the
now.
The snappy ones, the more ungainly...
Yeah, the ungainly but charming, old-fangled...
Yeah, 1.0. Like, what would the others be?
Well, like, game changer. What would be the... What did people say? It's a game changer. It's a whole new way of doing things.
It's an absolutely new way of doing things.
It's a completely new way of doing things.
Oh, I was talking to Bill last night. He said it was a completely new way of doing things.
He told you, have you seen it? It's an absolutely new way of doing things.
Guys, you check this out. This is an absolutely new way of doing things. Why is everyone using that phrase? I heard Bill using that phrase.
Please, would you stop saying it's an absolutely new way of doing things? Why can't we go back to saying it's an original solution to a very old problem? I think there probably was a snappier phrase than new way of doing things. But the other one I was thinking about was narrative. Well, that's depends on your narrative. They've got this whole narrative. We've got to change the narrative. And I think that's replaced, among other phrases, version of events, hasn't it? Well, that's your narrative.
Uh-huh.
So your narrative is...
Yeah, that's your version of the story.
This narrative that you're a struggling comedian, that's holding you back. You've got to change that narrative. Version of events? I don't know, maybe not.
But is there
narrative is so ubiquitous.
Is there not something implied in the word narrative used in that context that is a new idea?
No. I don't think so.
It's always been around.
Yeah.
The phrase that is completely unavoidable at the moment is to be fair.
Really?
Have you not noticed that?
To be fair.
To be fair.
God, that might mean I'm using it because I hadn't picked up on that. Haven't people said that for millennia?
I don't feel like it. That. Have they? No, I don't think so. I think it's in the last couple of years. To be
what
fair.
What about not being funny?
Not being funny.
I had a builder who said that, and you're like, God, Glenn always says not being funny. And then you find yourself using it.
That was around for a while. That was the to be fair of its day. And then that.
How would you use not being funny?
When you say something bitchy, I think, isn't it? Not being funny, but it wasn't very. That meal was kind of bad. I mean, no, is that?
That doesn't sound right.
Not being funny. Not being funny, but her face looks a bit weird. Isn't it? I feel like it's just laying some. It's excusing yourself from a bitchy comment.
Do you
usually
find you use the Urban Dictionary? So I use it quite a lot to online.
Occasionally, yeah. To find out what the hell things mean. I do it with acronyms all the time. It took me ages to figure out what SMH was.
SMH.
Shakes my head.
Ugh. Shakes my head.
Shaking my head.
Yeah, that's a new one on me. We talked about that. One of the first things we did on the podcast was talking about.
Yeah. Oh,
really?
Really?
That seems to have. I think we stamped it out.
It's subsided, hasn't it?
I feel a bit bad.
Yeah. Everyone was having
fun.
Really?
What about super as a prefix? Oh, it was super annoying. It was super fun. It was super great.
I'm going to go on Twitter right now and I'm going to see what people are saying. And this is just the people that I follow, so it's a skewed representation. This is the snowflake echo chamber libtard bubble.
Do you follow a lot of sort of alt-right...
I tried, but it was too depressing. I mean, I end up muting my fellow libtards a lot of the time. I mute quite a lot of people.
Is it okay to say libtards?
No, but it's what the alt-righters call us.
Right. No, I just wondered.
They're baiting the snowflakes by saying something that refers to or has the same.
I wonder how long it takes for something like, you know how words like bling becomes mainstream, like David Cameron sort of would use it, or what's another, chillax, or even jazz terms and hip-hop terms, right? Do words like bitch, does that then soon become... And queer is sort of okay now, kind of.
Is it?
Queer theory or...
Oh, yeah.
Queer studies or...
Is it still okay? Because that world changes very fast.
Gender queer. I don't know. Well, maybe it's one of those ones where I wouldn't use it, but...
I don't think bitch is okay.
But it's not now, but I've got the feeling... Because you know bitch has become sort of gender neutral. Oh, he's such a little bitch.
No, but that's very problematic, though.
Well, I agree. But in 20 years, don't you think probably it's going to be normalised?
Well, what's a good example of something that is no longer...
that's been defanged.
Problematic.
It's been sort of irradiated and made safe. I don't know. That's a great question.
Asshole? No, that's still pretty strong, isn't it? Fuck face.
What was rude? fuck face.
No. I mean, most things you can't really... They get phased out.
They don't get liberal. Well, yeah, maybe you're right. Ho? No.
Ho. That's no good.
Man ho?
Man ho.
Is that even a phrase?
No.
Should be. Maybe you're right. I'm going to reverse that. That doesn't work, does it? I had a theory that because terms like certain hip-hop, bits of hip-hop ease.
Yeah.
like, you know, get your groove on. I don't know. That's not even hip-hop. The only one I can think of is Bling, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm. I was watching...
Swag.
I was watching It'll Be All Right on the Night the other day, which is now hosted by Griff Rhys-Jones.
Okay.
Still some funny stuff on that show.
I used to love that.
Yeah, I really did.
Dennis Norden is still alive.
Is he?
And listens to Marc Maron's podcast religiously, I am reliably informed.
No
that,
way.
That's like his... He's plugged into comedy through Maron.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There's something quite sweet about that.
Yeah.
I think he must live in America, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Maybe he's just got family there.
I always liked him. And yeah, it was an amazing show back in the day when the idea of things going wrong on TV or films was just unimaginable. It felt as if you were peeking behind the magician's curtain.
It really did.
And it was so thrilling, wasn't it?
Oh, it was intoxicating.
Oh, my God. And now you just can't even conceive of what that would be like because...
That's a great recollection. I mean, that was like... I mean, that, when you saw that It'll Be All Right on the Night was on, it was like kiddie crack, wasn't it? Like,
yeah.
I'd be hyperventilating with mirth and excitement.
Right. And you'd see moments in Blue Peter or whatever where Peter Purvis is saying bloody hell or
yeah,
they have
getting
to bleep
bitten
him.
By the dog or someone advertising a sweet and it comes out of his mouth or...
Oh, and news presenters getting it wrong or falling over or...
Yeah.
Oh, my
and
God. This is amazing. I can't believe they're showing this. It felt like illegal or something. And now, of course, it's so banal. But I was amazed that watching the show the other night with Griff Rhys-Jones presenting, that there was still some pretty fucking funny stuff on
really?
There. A lot of funny things on QVC and places like that. You know, because obviously there's so much around now.
Yeah.
It's just a question of finding it. There's loads of stuff. I guess the cachet, as far as TV is concerned, is completely torpedoed by the internet because
yeah.
everything becomes an individual viral clip if
That's
it's any
right.
way funny. So you've probably seen it already. But there were quite a few things I hadn't seen before. Anyway, I mention it only because in one of his links, and I use the term loosely, like, oh my God, I don't know who writes those links. Good luck to them. I'll say that again because it's too bitchy. They're fucking awful. They're so fucking shit. Maybe I won't say it again. Cause, no, I don't know. I've retreated from
oh,
it.
Oh, Jesus. Someone, what do you think that guy's going to be listening and like... It's like, I love Adam Buxton's podcast.
There's a possibility.
Oh, it's a new one. I'm going to listen to it. And then get to that and be like,
he's talking about Griff's show. We wrote the links on that. Oh, cool. Oh, he liked it.
But maybe he knows it's shit. Maybe he's fine.
He must do. Oh, my God, they're so bad.
You've got to keep this.
Because I've done so many things.
We've all done things that are
that
shit.
Are shit, but I wouldn't like to hear people dragging them up again. And talking about them and laughing about them.
What's so shit about them?
So I'm trying to think of a good example. Oh, man. So, I mean, if he's going into a clip about news presenters screwing up and he'll be saying something like, now, in the world of news and current affairs, often looking for a good... This is useless. This is like my concession to the person who wrote the links is I'm doing a terrible
but
job.
It's hard to do that stuff, don't you think?
Of course it's hard. Of course it's hard, which is why it's unfair to trash them. Because it is hard and you would think it would be easy, but no. Anyway, the reason I mentioned It'll Be All Right on the Night was because in one of Griff Rhys-Jones's links, he used the phrase amazeballs in there.
Right.
And so I thought, oh, okay, there you go. That's the end of amazeballs. You know,
these things have a shelf life.
Yeah.
It was like...
And Joe... I think Joe reckons that he started Amazeballs.
Joe does.
I think he does. I think he said...
Wait, that can't be right, can it? He may well think that, but he didn't, did he?
I don't think. I mean, I think if... Because he reckons he used it like way back when we were on the radio, pre-Overground Amazeballs.
Well, he should look into that.
He certainly coined the phrase idiot hole, but that's never gone overground.
Idiot hole.
Yeah.
Yeah, that no one uses that phrase.
But it's a good phrase. It always used to make me laugh. So anyway, what we were going to talk about, though, before we got sidetracked there, was S-Town. Did you listen to the whole thing?
Yeah.
And did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of amazing. I mean, it's beautifully crafted, written, amazing intimacy, just a lot of thought and work had gone into it.
But it was more or less just a portrait of John B. McLemore, this fellow from Woodstock, Alabama.
So it turned out, yes. That promised, you could argue it promised to be a bit...
It promised to be an expose of small town corruption and...
there was some.
Was there?
I think.
None that I can recall. Nothing categorical. And then it turned into a bit of a treasure hunt after the fellow killed himself.
Yeah.
And he was unbanked, so there was gold lying around.
Yeah.
Have you Googled his maze on Google Maps?
I wanted to see what he looked like.
Yep.
Because he's got such an amazing voice, and I couldn't quite conjure him up in my head. And he turns out to be a sort of sexually ambiguous, but rather charismatic figure, and talks a lot about his tattoos and his piercings. So I looked him up on Google Images.
Can you do an impression of John B. McLemore?
What would you have to get a phrase,
okay, I'll give you a phrase.
Just say the phrase in a normal way.
All right. I was interested in the astrolabe, sundials, projective geometry, New Age music, climate change, and how to solve Rubik's Cube. There it is written down.
I was interested in the astrolabe, sundials, projective geometry, New Age music, climate change, and how to solve a Rubik's Cube. That's just me doing a southern accent.
Yeah, that was too...
I can't do it.
You haven't got the sibilance in
there.
What
is it? He had something that was... It was a very musical...
Yeah, it was a kind of sing-song quality sometimes.
That's good.
I was interested in the astrolabe, sundials, projective geometry, New Age music, climate change, and how to solve Rubik's Cube. You know, and it would kind of
climate change.
It's a little bit like a cross between Mr. Garrison and Mr. Mackey.
Yeah, that's good.
From South Park. I mean,
and he did a thing where he would laugh almost in derision, like, who's going to get you first? Cancer or Harrier Jim shitting on your face.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
You kind of had that.
Exactly. That kind of...
laughing out of a macabre contempt for life.
A bit like Bill Hicks, he reminded me of sometimes, his delivery. Not the accent necessarily.
It's kind of like a shit show where you're the main exhibit and you're going to choke on your own vomit. It's quite hard.
It's hard, isn't it? The Arctic ice is going to be pretty much gone in a year, and no one really seems to care about it. It's hard.
But why would you even care about that? I mean, it's just eternity and you being tortured to death by 1,000 different kinds of species gone rogue. You know, that's the vibe, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like
people are the world's so going to fucking shit and people are cynical totally anesthetized. And corrupt that it's a scabrous, scathing contempt for humanity, isn't it?
Here's a little clip of actual John.
You're going to use our best bits.
Yeah, yeah.
It's borderline embarrassing when you get it wrong.
Absolutely happened in this town.
Damn.
There's just too much little crap for something not to have happened. And I'm about had enough of shit town and things that goes on.
He's even more hillbilly than her. I just had about enough about shit town and the things that goes on. I mean, the music of his voice was a big part of what made that whole thing work, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And his total sort of emotional availability, his absolute thirst for whether it was a kind of intelligent interlocutor, but also a sense of being memorialized. You know what I mean? I think people talked about invasion of privacy. What's the name of the reporter?
Brian Reed.
Brian Reed got a bit of flack for allegedly being intrusive and... You know, that it was a non-consensual project in a sense, because actually there was a lot of material in it that, because he died, you know, he didn't know that that was going to turn out.
Details about his lifestyle and his homosexuality and things like that.
Specifically that.
Yeah.
But just the level of kind of forensic inquiry, most glaringly details about his sex life. There's a sort of, I mean, this may be shaky ground, but a kind of implied consent in the just the sheer sense of permission that he projected, like that he was loving having a chance to share his views, share his world, just to be listened to in that way.
Yes, exactly. And then pulling Brian Reed further into the whole world and doing things like showing him the suicide note on his computer and then only objecting in a kind of playful way when Brian Reed started reading parts of it out or something.
Right.
And saying, oh, you're not supposed to read it out. I just showed it to you. That's not, you know, you can't use that. Okay, let's put that away now.
Right.
And then because I feel as if I know quite a few people. I was talking to Adam Curtis on this podcast a while ago, and he was describing people with a very bleak worldview, a very pessimistic view of where we're headed as a species,
right,
as odierists, or people who were wringing their hands over climate change. He wasn't saying that, oh, we've got nothing to worry about. That's not what Adam Curtis was saying. But he was saying that the overwhelming pessimism, which you get from some people, of like, we are fucked. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He was calling that odierism.
Okay.
And kind of characterizing that as an affectation of a certain type of person.
Right.
And you definitely, and John B. McLemore in S-Town certainly fits into that.
Yeah.
Totally. Right?
Yes.
You know, going online and researching exhaustively these disturbing statistics about climate change and about all sorts of intergovernmental corruption and scandals and...
Catastrophism is another word for it.
Right.
And also reminiscent of, I don't know if you ever saw Collapse, Chris Smith's documentary.
I didn't.
It's worth watching. And Michael Rupert, the main character, is absolutely in the same, is a researcher who specializes in kind of catastrophist thinking and who's figured out that humanity is destined for a mass die-off in the next couple of decades.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great doc if you ever get the chance.
Well, I think I probably avoided it because I wasn't in the mood for a mass die-off in the next couple of decades.
But he's presented... He's not presented as a totally plausible expert. He's presented as someone who's...
It's a portrait of this person.
It's a portrait of an eccentric guy.
Okay.
Who you can't quite figure out... You have an instinct that perhaps it can't all be true, but... You can't really see the joins.
Well, that's always the fascinating thing about people like that, isn't it? Because part of you has to consider the possibility that they may be right and that it is just part of the human condition that we live in denial of these kinds of things and that we tell ourselves that that person is a catastrophist or an odierist or a pessimist of some kind. In as far as S-Town is concerned, the way they did that was to tie it all up by suggesting that he'd been poisoned by the mercury he was using.
I found that fairly plausible, didn't you?
I did, but then I found myself feeling guilty wanting to believe that a little too much because it enabled me to discount a lot of the depressing stuff that Macklemore was obsessed by. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yes. It's just great storytelling. I think it's amazing that I didn't feel cheated, given that it was, as you said, in the end, a kind of portrait of a very intriguing character, but not. It didn't have a sort of wider point.
And there were great peripheral characters as well, you know, all the people around. There was the fellow in the background who had been shot in the head or something.
Yes. You felt like they had to introduce him because he kind of trodden on all over their interviews.
Yeah, he would be in the background and he'd be basically interjecting and punctuating everything.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just money. It's all about money. Oh, yeah. You better believe it. Mm-mm. Yep, money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The scene that stayed with me for some reason was the one at the tattoo parlor.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I think
early on. It might be like the end of the second one. And it just felt like, oh, wow, he's in a small town tattoo parlor and everyone seemed to be kind of getting drunk and a little bit out of control and... You just felt Brian Reed was absolutely, it was kind of immersive journalism of a great kind.
Yeah, quite brave.
Yeah,
and
very exposing and interesting.
And he was, at that point, still investigating the possibility that there had been a murder and that one of these people who was actually in the bar at the time, I think, Cabram Burt, was responsible for killing some guy.
That's right.
And people were sort of saying, well, why'd you go up and ask him? He'll probably tell you. Yeah. And he was like, well, maybe not.
That's right.
And how did you get on with Brian Reed himself? Because he's definitely from that sort of This American Life NPR school of journalism. Do you remember there was a story on This American Life at one point?
About how they were getting hate mail about the voices of some of their...
Exactly. I think I made a note of it. This American Life episode 545. If you don't have anything nice to say, say it all in caps was the name of the... And one of the segments on there, it was described like this. Recently, This American Life has been getting a lot of hate mail about the young women on our staff. Listeners complain about their vocal fry. Ira investigates the phenomenon. And
vocal fry is creaky voice.
Creaky voice, right. And so it's something that,
like this.
Yeah, you get a lot with American women particularly, and that's why this story focused on that. And actually, I was a bit frustrated by it because I don't enjoy vocal fry.
No, but a lot of men do it too, to be fair.
Well, that's the thing.
Well,
there
I
you
said
go.
To be fair.
To be fair, yeah.
But that was to be fair.
That's fine, to be fair.
What about triggering? That's another one.
Oh, triggering. What did people say before triggering?
This may contain upsetting scenes. You know, like it was like... Some people may be upset by this.
Yeah. What did people say before intersectionality?
Gay?
No, but I mean...
I'm just kidding.
No, but you're like, what...
I don't even know what that means.
It just means when one issue crosses over with another issue and...
Cross-fertilization?
Yeah. Cross-pollination?
Hybrid?
Are affected by the same issue. I don't know. Anyway, so vocal fry, but on the This American Life piece, they very much spun it as sexism, that listeners were just excusing.
And perhaps they were misogynistic email. In fact, it sounds like they were.
A lot of them were, I think, yeah. They just basically didn't enjoy hearing intelligent women on the radio. Maggie claims that she hasn't been out of the house. Oh, this is Maggie.
It's hard to do, isn't it?
So hard.
So guess what? I decided to investigate. But the first thing you do when you're doing a story on lobsters is get a lobster.
That's quite good.
But that's easier said than done. And another thing is, I've always been afraid of lobster.
That's quite good. And as you pointed out, it's certainly not an exclusively... female.
No, it's not just female. But the thing is, it's married to a certain style. It's not just a vocal style. It's married to a certain kind of literal grammar, you know, a certain way of writing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sort of studied insouciance, or maybe it's a genuine, it's informality reified and made, you know, so instead of saying, I have decided to bring you a report about lobsters, you know, it's like, so, there I was looking at a lobster, you know, like... It's that bringing informal conversational speech, yeah, and saying that's how we're going to do this.
And the implication being that this is somehow more straightforwardly honest.
Yes. And of course, sometimes it can end up being more artificial. And certainly to English ears, because it's rampant on national public radio in America, not just on This American Life, in a way that it really isn't here. So to English ears, you're listening to the radio and thinking, it's a bit like straighten your back and sit up at the table and just talk. Robert, you know, it's because you just sort of, it feels a weirdly like lack of effort or kind of a phony attempt to be super relaxed.
Yeah. And the argument that they made on when they talked about it on This American Life was, well, this is just how we speak. There's nothing we can do about it. But actually, I think that's a bit disingenuous. And the reason I brought it up was that Brian Reed does it.
Yes.
In S-Town. He does it a lot. And the thing is that he only does it when he's doing his scripted voiceover pieces.
Right.
When you hear him interacting with people.
That's interesting.
In the field.
Aha. He doesn't choose.
He doesn't do it. Because as part of his regular conversational patterns, it would
Are
be.
Are you sure? Does he not do it when he does?
He does it on the phone, yes.
Oh.
He does it on the phone a little bit, but not that much. It's a different thing. Really? On the phone, when he's being told the sad news about John McLemore killing himself, he is upset, and so that's a different thing. But then there's a tone of sadness and emotionalism that creeps into the end of his sentences a lot when he's just doing his voiceover. I've got some examples for you. Here we go. I want to play these to you because I don't know. I sort of got obsessed by it, and I'm not sure if I'm imagining it or not. Very mean-spirited to focus on someone.
No, it's a terrific... Anyone who hasn't heard it, spoiler alert, it's an amazing podcast.
Oh, God, yeah, it's great. And this is just sort of S-level S-town, if you like. Here's some Brian Reed vocal fry. Emo fry, I'm calling it.
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me.
An antique clock restorer contacted me. Yeah, Brian, can you go for a take? It sounds great, but just try. Can you just try? It's only happening with your voice.
I don't know what you mean. I'll do it again.
Go for a take. It's just sounding a little bit, almost sort of too relaxed.
Uh-huh. Well, I do want it to sound relaxed. I'll try it again. Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me. Is that better?
I wonder without vocal fry, you lose intimacy, right? That would be the idea. So what does he say? What is the actual line?
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me.
So here's what I would say. Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me.
That sounds fine. That sounds like you're telling a story.
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me. It sounds more artificial, though, I guess.
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me.
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me. Contacted me. That was great, Louis. can we do another one for safety? And try saying... Try saying cause. I don't know. Is it contacted or contacted?
I've forgotten. Do most people say contacted? People say. The stress is on the first syllable, isn't it?
I can't remember. I thought. Let's get it both ways.
Just so we got it. Let's get contacted as well as contacted. And I'll tell you what, you could put a bit of emotion in the end there. Let's see how it sounds if you've got a suggestion of sadness at the end of the line.
Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me. I did some upspeak.
That's more like you're asking a question. I think we know that you have what it would be great is a suggestion of sadness.
Okay, I think I can do that. Years ago, an antique. Start again. Years ago, an antique clock restorer contacted me.
That's good.
That was too sad.
No, that's good.
Contacted.
I love it. Here's another real Brian Reed one.
And out of the back seat climbs Mary Grace with her cane, escorted by a middle-aged couple that I assume to be the cousins.
I don't think that's even vocal fry. What is that?
That's just upspeak, isn't it?
Cousins.
It's
like micro upspeak. Cousins.
The cousins.
It's like the end of the last syllable, escorted by the cousins. The
cousins. That would be good if he was a singer, though, I guess, wouldn't it? Escorted by a middle-aged couple that assume to be the cousins.
I also wonder because obviously the dean, the doyen, the maven of this world of sort of NPR radio is Ira Glass.
He does it, yeah.
I'm presuming he writes his scripts.
He writes the scripts and then he reads them out as if he's not reading them out.
So, I was sitting with Adam Buxton and I was sitting in a room. And you know how it is when a guy's scratching his beard and he's sitting across from you, he's wearing a cap, and he's got his hands on his jeans and they're too tight, and he's scratching his crotch and you're feeling sexually aroused. Well, this was kind of one of those occasions. And act one, it's all, can you do him?
No, I can't. But I would love to be able to. Oh, I really would. Because at one point I listened to so much This American Life that I really thought, fuck, I'm close to being able to completely get him.
One of his things is he doesn't pronounce his L's.
No, well, he's got the same thing that Maren does. So he's got film. A soft L.
He says film. Film.
Film.
You know, like, when you're watching a film?
Have you ever had... If you're somebody that's ever had illegal trouble?
Who are you doing? Who are you doing now?
I'm trying to say it like he does.
He's the words like milk. Film.
No, illegal.
I don't recognize that.
Illegal. He does. They're the L's, double L's.
Double L's?
Illuminating.
How does a double L sound different from a single L?
Illuminating.
He's fine with single L's. He can't do double L's.
He can say milk.
Is that legal or illegal?
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace. Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Rose, come here.
Ah, oh, there you are.
Hello, sweetie. Couldn't see you.
That was Louis Theroux. Hope you enjoyed that. Ridiculous, rambly chat. And I would like to thank Louis. I'd also like to thank my friend Mark, who let us record that conversation in his front room in his house in London one afternoon in June. And then when we had finished talking, we went and sat in Mark's garden. And Mark's an old friend of me and Louis. And so we sat there and had a few beers, shot the breeze, and it was a lovely evening. Thanks as well to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support and Matt Lamont for super edit skills. Thank you, Matt, very much. Now, what else can I tell you, listeners? Not that much to report. Still waiting on the app at the moment. The stuff tends to move very slowly in the world of a dotard like myself. It's a little topical reference for you there. Whoa! It's not going to mean anything in the future, is it? But to put it in some kind of meaningful context, it's a word that cropped up in a relatively terrifying speech from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un this week. And I mean, the terrifyingness of the speech was leavened somewhat by the word dotard when applied to Donald Trump. And I think it's safe to say that many of us were delighted by how appropriate this word was, and a word that we weren't familiar with before, many of us. Sounded as if it was like a made-up insult. Earlier on, I was talking with Louis about the word libtard, and this seems to be the same sort of thing applied to Donald Trump, a dotard. But no, it's a real word, meaning an old, weak or senile person. But the thing is, I don't think Kim Jong-un came up with the word dotard. I think he wrote something in, or his speechwriters wrote something in Korean. I think we have to thank whoever translated the speech for the word dotard. Why aren't they getting their props? I really don't think that Kim Jong-un should be getting any props. What with being bent on escalating the atmosphere of fear, tension and impending violence in the world. I mean, yes, he looks terrific. There's no argument from me there. He's got it all going on look-wise. But I don't think he deserves extra credit for his language skills. That's just a personal perspective. So there you go. I got bitten. I'm starting to say this as if it's a story. It's not really. It's just something that occurred to me. Because my right elbow is itchy. A week ago, though, exactly 1 week ago, I was in the woods on a camping trip in Dartmoor. I go out there. Well, we try and go out there about once a year. Me and my friend, and Garth Jennings, you know Garth, friend of the podcast, and a few other pals. And we string up our hammocks and spend a couple of nights under the stars in Dartmoor. It's beautiful. And we sit around the fire and tell stories and sing songs and set the world to rights. But on the very first night, I sat down in my camping chair and we were all having a bit of stew. Our friend Tom had cooked up a delicious, hearty stew on the campfire. And I was just about to tuck in when I felt a little tickling in my right sleeve, the sleeve of my fleece. And I thought, what the? Yeah, I shook my arm a little bit to try and dislodge it. I assumed it was an ant. And I thought, well, get out, an ant. I thought it was out. A minute or so later, I feel another tickle. What the, ant? What are you doing there? Boy, he's tenacious, I thought. And then I started to reach up with my left hand up the sleeve of the fleece to try and sort out the situation. As I did so, I felt a sharp, hot needle of pain in close proximity to my elbow. And I got bit. It was really unpleasant. It's always such a shock when you get bitten by one of God's creatures. I haven't had a sting for a while. But if you can't see what stung you, it's a little bit more alarming. So I was like, what the heck is up there? So I withdrew my hand quickly and I pinched the outside of the sleeve of the fleece to try and, immobilize whatever was in there munching. And there was a significant lump in there. Not an ant, in other words. So then I sort of kept hold of this lump and turned the sleeve inside out and was able to see that it was a big old spider in there. Big bulbous abdomen. And the abdomen was dark in colour with sort of blue markings. And then I looked it up. When I got home, I looked up, spiders that might bite you. And it looked, I tell you, like a false widow spider to me. That sounds bad. And they came over to the UK relatively recently, and there was a certain amount of interest in them, a few news stories about them. But actually, it's no worse than being stung by a bee or something. But still, it was a bit of a shock. And I didn't know that at the time, and I started just imagining, my brain went crazy imagining, oh, this is a new species, and it's climate chaos, and deadly spiders are now happy to live in this country, and they come over on a fruit crate, I don't know what, and now they've crawled up Buckles' fleece, and they're munching. So I was a bit distracted by that, and sure enough, it was quite painful and it swelled up, not alarmingly, but a bit. And then it's been sort of going through various stages throughout the week, itching, and the pain has gradually ebbed away. But I survived. Oh, I'm a trooper. Anyway, that's what I was doing this time last week. Getting bitten by a false widow, or whatever else it was, I don't know. Well, that's it for this week, I guess. Back next week with another. Until then, do take exceptionally good care. And remember that I love you.